I was attacked while walking my dog after school one day by a man in the neighborhood. And after sexually assaulting me, he beat my head in with a rock, left me with a brain disorder, and I ruined it. I became a young alcoholic and a drug addict at a young age, and for many years just was lost.
In the late 1970s, Nick Yaris was a troubled kid living in Philadelphia. He'd survived a horrific sexual assault by a stranger as a child. And after that traumatic experience, he began to turn to crime and to drugs. It became a vicious cycle. The more he got hooked on meth, the more he needed to steal so he could buy it. And when he was still just a teenager, he thought he'd figured out the jackpot, the steady hustle that he'd been waiting for to fuel his addiction, stealing cars. Nick and his buddy Eddie would break into cars and steal them together, deliver them to a crooked auto repair shop, get paid $200, take that cash, buy drugs, and then repeat the whole cycle. It became almost routine, so much so that Nick can still point to his favorite vein, the vein that he'd used to get high after the adrenaline from boosting a car wore off. It's December 20th, 1981. Nick Yaris has just boosted two cars, and he's out for a joyride to celebrate. His adrenaline is raging, he's high, and the radio is on full blast. Nick blows through a stop sign, and it's just his luck. He does it right in front of a cop. Nick panicked. As the officer moved to arrest him, Nick reached for the cop's nightstick. There was a struggle, two men in the dark, one a police officer just doing his job, and one high while driving a stolen car. Suddenly, the officer's gun went off. Thankfully, the bullet didn't hit anything. But that's when the officer got the upper hand. It's when he shoved Nick into the backseat of the car and drove him to jail.
They take me back to the cell, and there was the newspaper. The December 16th Delaware County Daily Times. And right there was the story of Linda Mae Craig.
In 1981, Linda Mae Craig was a 33-year-old mother of three. She worked at the Tri-State Mall on the Delaware side of the border with Pennsylvania, just off Interstate 95. And on December 15th, 5 days before Nick was arrested during his joyride, Linda Mae was abducted, raped, and murdered. Her shoes were found in the parking lot of the mall where she worked. Her car was found abandoned and empty. And then, her body was found, dumped in the parking lot of a local church.
Something about that newspaper kept calling me.
An idea popped into Nick's head. And at the time, he thought this was an ingenious idea, something that could actually work as a way to get him out of jail. Since he was facing a long prison sentence for assaulting a police officer, resisting arrest, and driving a stolen vehicle, Nick figured that he could just lie his way to freedom. So he made up a story about Linda Mae Craig, saying that he knew the guy who did it, the murderer who dumped her body in the church parking lot. In his head, if he helped the cops solve that case, they might go easy on him. They might even let him off the hook. So he whipped up a bogus story and tried to pin it all on a guy he knew, a guy named Jimmy. But there was just one problem. There was this one thing about Jimmy that Nick didn't know at the time. And that one fact, that one piece of information, that would forever change Nick's life. What Nick didn't know about Jimmy was this. Jimmy was dead. When the police realized that Jimmy was dead and had died before Linda Mae Craig was murdered, they realized that Nick had to be lying. But he had been convincing enough to make them suspicious. Why had he brought up the murder in the first place? How could he have even known about it if he wasn't involved? And in that fateful instant, as they asked those questions, Nick became the prime suspect. Nick Yaris was tried and convicted of the murder and rape of Linda Mae Craig based on the story that he made up. And in 1982, Nick was sentenced to death and sent to death row, where he would spend the next 22 years of his life as a dead man walking. I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. In the last episode, we looked at the death penalty in the United States through the eyes of Michelle Lyons, a reporter turned spokesperson for the Texas Department of Corrections, who personally witnessed nearly 300 executions. If you haven't listened to that one yet, you might want to go back before continuing on this episode. But what we didn't go into much last episode were the principles behind capital punishment. Is it moral? Can you justify executions ethically? And why or why not?
So where to begin? Well, the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution in the United States bars cruel and unusual punishment.
This is Emily.
I'm Emily Bazelon.
She's a writer for the New York Times Magazine and the author of a new book about criminal justice reform that's called
Charged: The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration.
And one of the things that Emily writes about is how the death penalty is facing new legal challenges in the United States.
And the death penalty remained a common and popular practice really through the 90s, even into the 2000s. But there's been increasing discomfort with it in a number of states. And I think that's because of a few things. There have been well-publicized wrongful convictions and a lot of fear that we could execute an innocent person. There's been a mounting set of concerns about how expensive the death penalty is, how these appeals drag on for many years and, in fact, can be bad for the families of victims because the cases continue and there's no closure.
But let's back up for a second to just introduce a few key facts. Since 1976, when the death penalty was reinstated by a Supreme Court ruling, there have been roughly 1,500 inmates executed in the U.S. Currently, there are 30 states that have capital punishment as a legal option for criminal sentencing. But the number of states that actually execute people, and the number of people who are killed each year by the death penalty, has been falling. In 1999, there were nearly 100 inmates executed across the United States. For the last few years, though, that number has fallen to about 24 per year. So overall execution numbers are way down.
And a lot of cities that used to use it regularly have kind of pulled away from it. And so what we see is that the death penalty has become concentrated in a very small number of American counties.
Of the 25 people who were executed in the U.S. in 2018, more than half of them were killed in Texas. The other states that executed people were Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Nebraska, Ohio, South Dakota, and Tennessee. And in those states, there are only a handful of counties that tend to produce most of the death sentences. Many states, like Minnesota, where I'm from, have never had the death penalty.
And then there are these set of concerns about moral opposition to the death penalty, but also the method of execution.
In the overwhelming majority of cases, inmates are executed by lethal injection.
So we now effectively drug people to death, and there are a lot of worries about the kinds of medications that states are using and whether they cause a lot of pain in the act of killing.
But it might surprise you to know that other methods have been used recently, too. Take a guess. When was the last time that someone was executed in an electric chair in the United States? Was it 30 years ago? 20? Nope. It was just a few months ago, on December 6th, 2018, in Tennessee. How about the last time that there was an execution by firing squad, where an inmate is lined up and shot to death? The 60s or 70s? Nope. not that long ago either. June 18th, 2010, in Utah. The last time a prisoner was put to death in a gas chamber in the United States was March 3rd, 1999, in Arizona. And the last hanging of a prisoner in the United States was only 23 years ago, on January 25th, 1996, in Delaware. Whatever you think of the death penalty and the various methods of execution, the data are pretty clear that Americans generally support the death penalty, at least in some circumstances.
The support for the death penalty among Americans has ebbed, but it is still at more than 60%. So it's still the majority position.
But it's important to note, too, that as with all polls, it depends a bit on how you ask the question. And that majority support masks a bit of nuance that is important.
When you ask people if they would prefer a life without parole sentence to an execution, more than half of Americans will say yes.
So when it comes to the American public, the jury is divided, so to speak. Some people support the death penalty. Others think it's barbaric. So let's try to think about it systematically and think through the arguments on both sides. When you're trying to figure out whether the death penalty is justified, you have to split the arguments into two camps, the practical and the philosophical. The practical arguments are all about the implementation of the death penalty, the racial bias in conviction rates, the method of execution, or the possibility of executing an innocent man. Those are all very real concerns and very real challenges, and we'll get to them in a moment. But perhaps the dimension that's harder to grapple with is the philosophical. Why wouldn't you execute the worst of the worst, the Hitlers or the Bin Ladens of the world, or the Timothy McVeighs and Ted Bundys, the monsters who so brazenly take so many innocent lives? Don't they deserve to die for killing so many other people?
Then you really come back to an argument in favor of the death penalty that's based on retribution and just your sense that people who commit terrible murders deserve to die themselves. And obviously, there are people who strongly believe that to be true.
So imagine this thought experiment. You have a machine. And yes, I know this machine doesn't exist, and I know it will never exist. It's impossible. But just indulge me for a minute. So in this imaginary world, this machine is 100% accurate at figuring out whether someone is innocent or guilty. It never gets it wrong. Never. Someone guilty walks in, it buzzes. Someone innocent walks in, it dings. And one day, a murderer comes into the courtroom. He's accused of killing 50 people, all innocent victims, some of them children, for no reason whatsoever. The evidence is overwhelming. He's evaluated by this machine, and it's crystal clear. He did it. He's guilty. And then, he's evaluated by doctors, by mental health experts, and they determine that he had a perfectly pleasant upbringing, good schools, good parents, lots of opportunities. And he also has good mental health, no disorders, no mitigating circumstances. And in this imaginary scenario, you're on the jury. You know he's guilty. And what you have to decide is this: should he be executed? And if you said no, would you say the same if the man in the courtroom were Hitler, or Stalin, or Osama bin Laden? That thought experiment is a pretty useful one in determining whether, aside from all the practical problems associated with the American justice system, you're in favor of the death penalty in an abstract philosophical sense. Because some people will say, no way, the death penalty is always morally wrong. And others will say, well, as long as we know he did it and there weren't any mitigating circumstances like mental illness, then yeah, go ahead, strap him to the gurney and get on with it. And so, to help us think through these philosophical issues, I spoke to my friend, Jeff.
I'm Jeffrey Howard. I'm a lecturer in political theory at University College London.
And the first thing I asked Jeff was this: can you rule out the moral justification of the death penalty just because there's a risk of false positives. In other words, since we don't have that hypothetical magic machine I spoke about, and given that there's a real risk that we might actually put someone innocent to death, shouldn't we just rule out the death penalty for that reason alone? Jeff said that it's not so simple, at least in terms of a philosophical argument.
It seems clear that any suitably designed criminal justice system will end up having some false positives. That is to say, it's going to end up convicting some people who are innocent. But as a society, we've made a call that it's acceptable to subject everyone to some small risk that you're going to be unjustly convicted of a crime you didn't commit.
But of course, the stakes are different with the death penalty. It's irreversible. Once the lethal injection starts, it doesn't matter if you later find exonerating evidence. But still, Jeff said that that possibility is not quite enough to convince a philosopher on that point alone.
And indeed, even if it's true that you can unincarcerate someone, you can let someone out of prison, whereas you can't unkill them, the devastation to one's life that is affected by years, decades in prison can't be undone. And so I think that the mere fact of false positives probably doesn't suffice to establish that execution is wrong.
In other words, if we thought about the risk of false positives, we'd probably have to stop putting people in jail altogether. Because it's horrifying enough to think of having someone in solitary confinement for, say, 60 years for a crime they didn't commit. So, perhaps the best way to think about this question of whether we can philosophically justify the death penalty or not is to zoom out and think about what the purpose of criminal justice actually is.
Think about why we might justify punishment generally.
What's the point of all those jails? Why do we punish criminals? Are we trying to lower crime rates by getting bad people off the streets? Are we trying to rehabilitate them so that they stop being criminals in the hopes that their second chance is better than their first? Are we trying to deter future criminals who fear the consequences of a life of crime? Or are we just trying to inflict a sort of eye-for-an-eye sense of justice on those who commit crimes? And Jeff is going to walk us through the main ways that people tend to think about those questions.
So one approach, and this is the approach I think that many people who defend capital punishment are most inclined to invoke, is the approach that says that the purpose of punishment is retribution. And on this view, when we punish people, we don't do so because of the future good consequences, because we're trying to reduce the crime rate, because we're trying to deter others from committing crimes in the future. We punish people because they deserve it. And there's something pretty intuitive about that. When you do something really awful, you don't get to have your life just go on uninterrupted. It's important that your life grind to a halt and you be held accountable for what you've done. And the basic insight, which is that when you do wrong to others, you deserve to suffer yourself, is a pretty powerful one.
It's punishment for the sake of punishment. And it's a reasonably widespread belief, too.
For some people, it's just a matter of brute conviction. So we just know it in our gut that if you do something awful, you kidnap and rape and murder somebody, you deserve to suffer as a response to that. No further argument necessary. Other people try to give a bit more philosophical arguments. So they might say that punishing you levels the playing field. So you don't deserve to break the rules of our society with impunity, whereas everyone else is abiding by those rules. Other people appeal to the value of victims' lives and say, well, what we do when we punish you is we reassert the dignity and the value of your victim's life, which you took away by harming them.
There's even evidence that this argument based on retribution may have a basis in evolutionary biology, that we evolved to believe in that principle.
It probably served the development of the species to have this fundamental desire to lash out and strike back at those who harm us.
But for the most part, thinking about punishment as a form of retribution is backward-looking. It's not trying to rehabilitate the inmate. It's not trying to deter crime. It's just punishing them because of something that happened in the past. And from that philosophical perspective, it doesn't really matter whether the punishment achieves any particular goal in the future. But then there's this tricky question. What is the proportionate amount of punishment or of retribution that someone deserves?
The central idea here is that people deserve to suffer when they do wrong, but they only deserve to suffer in proportion to the harms they've caused. So, for example, a policy of executing all thieves strikes even the most ardent retributivist as wrong because it's disproportionate. It would overpunish them. It would give them more than they deserve. Likewise, giving a brutal murderer a community service order would strike us as disproportionately light.
So one of the problems with the retributivist philosophy when it comes to creating sentencing guidelines is that to be consistent, to really go for that eye for an eye mentality, you'd need the government to do some truly sick things. Take, for example, the surviving Boston Marathon bomber, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who is currently awaiting execution in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, known as the Alcatraz of the Rockies. Some people who believe criminal justice is all about retribution would look at that case and they would say, this was a guy who blew up marathon runners and child spectators near the finish line. He's getting off far too easily with the needle.
One of the questions that was asked to prospective jury members during jury selection was whether they thought execution would be an excessively harsh punishment. And some jurors suggested that they thought it might be an excessively light punishment, and that perhaps if you've done something truly heinous, death constitutes an easy way out. And so it might be that retributive justice requires that people suffer for a long time.
If that point of view sounds about right, then you're probably a retributivist. If it sounds harsh and morally repugnant to you, then you're probably not. But you might be someone who believes in punishment for deterrence, someone who thinks that criminals need to deal with harsh consequences to stop future crimes.
So another approach to justifying criminal punishment appeals not to the idea that wrongdoers deserve to suffer, like defenders of retribution say. Instead, it appeals to the idea that the purpose of criminal punishment is to provide security from crime. So why do we punish people? Well, so that everyone else can see that when you do something wrong, when you do something that breaks the rules of the society, look what happens to you.
But, and this is where we deviate a bit from philosophy to pragmatism, the research that's been done on the death penalty and the future crime rate doesn't seem to show that the threat of execution actually stops people from committing future murders. Or at least there's no convincing evidence to show that.
And we have no reason to think that it actually deters murder. There's been lots of research done on this. It's a heavily contested question. And my own reading of the research suggests that in the end, like, we just can't prove that we need the death penalty to deter crime. States that have eliminated the death penalty have not seen their murder rates rise, to the contrary. And so I think if you are asking the question of, do we need this punishment in order to prevent future murders, the answer is no.
This debate is inconclusive, and I think the fact that it's inconclusive is ethically significant. We tend to think that it's only permissible, it's only okay to impose harm on people when we think, when we're reasonably confident that imposing that harm is necessary to accomplishing some good aim. So if we know that we can stop an attacker by shooting them in the leg, then the police are supposed to shoot him in the leg. They're not supposed to shoot him in the head. I think a similar principle applies in cases of criminal punishment. So if you're not sure whether execution is necessary to achieve the aim that you're after, namely greater deterrence, I think that there's a moral imperative not to opt for that severe punishment unless there's conclusive evidence to the contrary. And there simply hasn't been that evidence to the contrary.
If you've ever taken a philosophy class or had the good fortune to have a beer with a philosopher, like I have with Jeff, you'll know that they always like to twist the knife just a bit with the what-if questions. Jeff loves the what-if questions. And here he says, okay, let's imagine that a new study were to come out with convincing evidence that shows the death penalty does reduce crime. What then?
Let's assume that we knew that by executing murderers, we could save 100 more innocent lives per year. Would it be justified then to execute murderers? And the answer is not necessarily. Because even the most plausible deterrent theory will recognize some upper ceiling on how much punishment is permissible. So it seems pretty plausible that you could slash the rate of theft pretty considerably by executing all thieves. And yet most people have a view that it's not okay to execute thieves. So there's some proportionality constraint that seems to be in play even within the context of a deterrent theory.
If there wasn't some upper limit, then you'd be obligated by that compelling philosophical force called logic to institute some truly awful punishments.
Suppose that evidence suggested that slowly torturing murderers to death was really effective at deterring murder. Again, it's not obvious that that would be a sufficient argument for slowly torturing all murderers to death. A lot of people think that that would be barbaric, that that would be wrong, even though it was an effective deterrent.
Okay, but what about those people out there who are thinking, both of these ideas are ridiculous. Punishment isn't supposed to be an eye for an eye, and it's not supposed to be about deterrence either. Instead, maybe it's supposed to rehabilitate the prisoner, to help them reform their ways so they can become a functioning member of society again once they're released from prison. And the thing is, if you're one of those people, then odds are pretty good that you oppose the death penalty, at least if you're being logical about it.
Now, if you hold a view of the sort that I defend, if in other words you think that a major purpose of criminal justice should be rehabilitation, well, then it's pretty obvious why capital punishment would be ruled out. Namely, what's the point of rehabilitating people if only to kill them?
So now that we've thought through the philosophy, what about Nick Yaris, the car thief who was wrongfully sent to death row in Philadelphia in the early 1980s? What does his case tell us about capital punishment more generally? And to figure that out, I needed to speak to Nick Yaris.
My name is Nick Yaris. I'm 57 years old. As a drug addict and a car thief, I ran afoul of the law one night while driving a stolen car in the city of Chester, Pennsylvania in December of 1981.
And as I mentioned before, Nick's trial ended in a conviction and a death sentence. Solitary confinement. Depression. Beatings. Nick's life in prison was on a downward spiral. A spiral that he knew would end only one way, with him strapped to a gurney, with a needle that would kill him, stuck into his arm. But Nick's outlook changed with a grisly event that happened while Nick was in prison. It changed because someone in a cell nearby committed suicide.
Prison officer stopped at a cell that was empty because a man committed suicide, and he offered me books from that cell. And with that humble beginning, I began this plethora of education that went on for thousands of volumes.
Nick only had a basic reading level, to say the least, probably something that you'd expect from someone just entering middle school. But he had something else in abundance. He had a lot of time. And Nick used that time to follow the lessons of something called the General Education Development Booklet, which said that you could learn any word so long as you could write it down 10 times and then write it down in 10 different sentences. So Nick started doing that to fill his days, growing his vocabulary every day, all while reading novel after novel after novel, taking trips in his head, allowing him to travel far outside the cramped confines of his jail cell in the pages of a book.
I circumnavigated the globe while sitting in a cell. I used the analogy that I was like a neutrino. A neutrino is the most fascinating object that we know about in physics. It passes right through the Earth every day. These small particles emanate from the sun millions of miles away, and they pass through whatever surface they meet. Doesn't matter if it's a diamond or concrete or steel. These things know no boundaries.
And as he traveled around the world, from the words on a page, he also learned some truly obscure words, the kind of words that poets and professors have to look up in the dictionary, including the word triskaidekaphobia, a word that means the fear of the number 13. If you're interested, by the way, The Fear of 13 is also the title of a wonderful documentary available on Netflix about Nick, and it's the title of his book, too. But even as Nick read voraciously, learned new words, discovered new worlds, he was still, at the end of the day, going to sleep on death row. And each day was bringing him closer to that inevitable needle. Nick tried to stay upbeat about it. And so sometimes he would try to think about it as though he wasn't there because he had been convicted of murder or rape, but that he was on some sort of undercover adventure.
And I'm living around cannibals and serial killers, and it's fascinating. And I start studying psychology and dissecting them, and it's just full on, man. It was the greatest adventure of my life, man. It's like being hired by the BBC to go do an underground, you know, documentary about the death penalty, but you got to be on death row.
Of course, when the filming ends, documentary crews leave the prison. And that was the only thing that Nick had in common with them, at least briefly, in the mid-1980s. On a bitterly cold day in early 1985, Nick was being transported to court for an appeal that he had pending. And when the sheriff stopped for gas, there was a mix-up. One of the two sheriffs got separated from Nick when Nick went to the bathroom. And Nick, freezing out in the cold weather, started jogging back to his car. But the other sheriff got alarmed that Nick is running towards him, and his partner is nowhere to be found. And if you put yourself in the sheriff's shoes, you can understand it. There's a death row inmate, a convicted murderer, running at you. And you have to wonder whether your partner has just been killed, which is the reason why he's not with the inmate. So the sheriff pulls out a gun. He fires one shot. The bullet whizzes by Nick's ear. And in that moment, Nick is sure he's about to be killed. Not on a gurney, but in a gas station parking lot, his blood freezing out on the asphalt. So Nick runs. And he manages to escape. Once out of sight, with sirens now blaring everywhere and squad cars screaming toward the gas station, Nick takes off his glasses and he manages to use the pin from them to pick the lock on his handcuffs. But it's still freezing outside. There's a huge search team, and there's a helicopter searching overhead. But what Nick didn't know, and what the helicopter crew didn't know, was that it was so cold that their infrared search equipment was malfunctioning. And that malfunction allowed Nick to make it a few miles away from the gas station, to a town called Fraser, Pennsylvania, where he stole a car, just like in his teenage days, and got out of the state. Eventually, after about a month on the run, Nick turned himself in. And it landed him right back on death row, where he discovered the joys of books and reading and unfamiliar words. But still, there's this nagging fact. One simple fact that you can't forget if you're an innocent man on death row.
I didn't do it.
But few people believe that fact. So Nick got closer and closer to his execution. He kept trying to fight to get DNA testing done, a new technology at the time, because he knew that it would show that he wasn't the real killer. And as he kept losing court battle after court battle, it became clear that there wasn't going to be any testing. So he wrote a letter to the governor in August of 2002, requesting to be executed without further delay.
I had to ask to be executed. So I came as close as being executed to 60 days around, because the court was going to let me go with my wish to be executed, notwithstanding any confirming DNA results.
That letter, it turned out, got the governor's attention. DNA testing was carried out. They had good samples from whoever killed Linda Mae Craig.
There was two different DNA profiles, and neither one of them matched me.
That DNA test was as close as you could come to the hypothetical machine I talked about before. Nick Yaris was innocent. On September 3rd, 2003, Nick became the 140th person in the United States to be exonerated by post-conviction DNA testing. And he became part of a much smaller club of unfortunate individuals, those who were exonerated from death row, where they would have been put to death had the DNA testing not been carried out.
I am one of the only 22 human beings on the planet, exonerated by DNA evidence after being sentenced to death in America for rape and murder.
On January 16th, 2004, Nick Yaros walked out of prison a free man. And I asked him about that first day, after thousands and thousands of days behind bars.
So we stopped at a restaurant to get something to eat first. Although I couldn't eat anything more than a dinner roll, I had a really good time when my father asked me to go outside with him and sit down and just talk to him. So while the others were still in the restaurant, he turned to me and he said, "Nick, I have been dying to just ask you this. What's changed? Like, can you look around right now and tell me, what is it in society that's the one thing that's truly changed?" And I looked at him, I looked around, and I said, "I know what it is." And he said, tell me, because I'm just dying to know. I said, "It's hubcaps, Pop. There ain't no more hubcaps on the car. Everything's alloy wheels, and if they are not, they're plastic covers to make them look like they're alloy. There's no more fancy hubcaps." And he said, "Oh, shucks, I knew it was something like that." He said, "You never even noticed that they're gone, huh?" So then he asked me, "Did you know that they put security strips inside of money?" And as I sat there with him, I watched him coming back to life. He's seeing his son for the first time in 23 years. And I'm doing everything I can to keep him elevated, you know? And he says to me that money has just been so changed that it's so high tech that I wouldn't believe that they actually have holograms in the money. And I told him to show me. So he gave me a $20 bill and I stuck it right in my pocket. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Hey, I'm still your little boy. And I need pocket money to get around with. Thank you." He needed to know that I was still witfully alive and still able to be interactive and kind with others. And it really made the rest of the journey that day better.
Nick's story ends with him exonerated rather than executed. But his story also raises an obvious question. How many people on death row are actually innocent? How many people have been executed even though they didn't commit the crime that they were charged with? And the answer is that we will never know for sure. But Nick, for his part, can keep learning and reading, and most importantly, experiencing the world for himself, not just through books anymore. He currently lives in Oregon with his family.
I'm in southern Oregon on the coast, and it's one of the most beautiful places on earth.
And now that he's off death row and out of prison, Nick tries to share his story with the world in the hopes that others in the future won't experience the same fate of spending 22 years on death row, or worse, for a crime that they didn't commit. So let's zoom out from Nick's story to the entire population of death row in the United States. There are roughly 2,600 inmates slated to be executed in the U.S. right now. All but 55 of them are men, which means that just 2% of death row inmates are women. And most of them are going to be there for quite a while. From the moment that a death row inmate is convicted and sentenced to death, the average inmate waits 12 years before they are actually executed, largely due to appeals and a variety of other legal challenges to the process that take time. And some legal challenges to capital punishment itself, to the constitutionality of the death penalty, are gaining steam.
So in 2013, Justice Stephen Breyer wrote a really important dissent about the death penalty in a case called Glossop versus Gross. And Breyer was asking the question of whether, at this point in American history, we should decide that, or the Supreme Court should decide that the death penalty is unconstitutional. One of the reasons Breyer gave is he thinks that there's convincing evidence that innocent people have been executed in three states. And Breyer also described near misses.
Gregory Joseph, who works with the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, agrees. And he says that the execution of innocent people is really just a numbers game.
In order to kind of get a number of people who might have been innocent who have been executed, you really just kind of have to, you know, look at it from a statistical standpoint. I mean, we don't have any clear-cut evidence that somebody was innocent. We probably know that, you know, there are people who've been executed that had high degrees of innocence claims before they were executed, but we don't actually know of anyone who was actually sent to death who was quote-unquote innocent. But if you just look at the totality of the death penalty and all the people who've been executed, and you just kind of look at a plus-minus of, you know, just a random sample of someone had of that group of thousands of people, some of them had to be innocent.
This, to me, is a pretty convincing argument. And the risk of killing an innocent person is so egregious, so horrifying, that it would take a lot of evidence on the other side to convince me that it's worth running the risk. But the other aspect that's both convincing and horrifying is the racial bias that is embedded in capital cases.
Racial bias plays a significant role in the application of the death penalty in America, and capital punishment is used disproportionately against people of color.
One of the most troubling aspects of the American death penalty is that it has always been infected by racial disparity, and I would say by straight-up racism. And what I mean by that is that since the 70s, we have had a lot of research suggesting, and now I think really proving, that juries are much more likely to sentence someone to death for killing a white person. So it's not as simple as we sentence more black people to death, although that is disproportionately true. It is also that we punish people for killing white people more, which is like another weird form of valuing life differently depending on the race of the victim.
Time and time again, we've seen studies that show that the death penalty is sought more often against people who kill victims that are white than victims that are African-American and Hispanic. There's actually no longer a dispute over whether or not discriminatory sentencing in capital cases is based on the race of the victim.
Gregory and Emily are right about that. The debate over whether there is racial bias in capital sentencing is pretty much settled. There is, and it's systematic. Whether you support or oppose the death penalty, I hope that we should all be able to agree that the cases should involve a certain level of basic fairness, where it matters what the crime was, not the skin color of the perpetrator or the victim. But we should also wonder whether it's fair to have people get sentenced to death out of a fluke of circumstance. Should it matter whether a murder was committed on one side of a county line or another? Should it matter which prosecutor ends up working the case? And should it matter whether that prosecutor is trying to make a name for themselves as they run for political office?
And I think that there's a deep conviction that a lot of people share that a criminal justice system has to treat like for like. It has to treat similar crimes similarly.
So one of the things that Emily wondered was, why is it that the overwhelming majority of death penalty convictions are concentrated in such a tiny number of counties? And the answer, she found, lies with the fact that you need three overlapping factors to be in place whenever a murder is committed for it to end in a death sentence.
So you need a law that's still on the books, obviously, and then you need a prosecutor willing to demand the death penalty and a judge that's willing to impose it, and a jury, I should say, too. And that concentration of factors is present now in a vanishingly small number of counties, but those counties still produce, we're now at about 40 or so death sentences a year.
As Emily found in her reporting, you're more likely than not to end up with a sentence of life in prison, even in counties where the death penalty is legal, unless the prosecutor assigned to your case is trying to make a name for themselves as someone who is tough on crime, possibly with an eye to a future election. And that's the case in a small number of counties,
which almost always have hard-charging law and order prosecutors.
So there's a certain randomness or arbitrariness to the application of the death penalty in the United States. On the one hand, you've got racial bias, and on the other hand, you have geographic flukes, where you're treated differently if you commit your crime in a certain county, or you're treated differently depending on whether or not the prosecutor has political ambitions. These all seem like pretty powerful objections to me. But there are other objections that are often raised that I find far less persuasive, like the idea that the state just categorically should never kill people.
And I think this view, while initially attractive, is probably wrong. So in an active shooter situation in a school, we think not only that the state is morally permitted to kill a shooter to protect the lives of innocent children, providing this is the only way of stopping him, we think the state is morally required to do that. Now you might reply, well, but that's in a sudden situation when the threat of harm is imminent. What's wrong about capital punishment is that it's the state systematically setting out to kill people. But I think when it comes to fighting wars, war is a mechanism by which the state systematically sets out to kill people. And yet we nevertheless think that wars can be justified. So I don't think the idea that the state should just never kill or should never kill systematically are going to be very persuasive arguments for getting rid of capital punishment.
Then there is this really complicated question of how to cope with the perspective of victims' families. How much weight should we give to the desires of a victim's mother or father or child to see their loved one's killer put to death?
We tend to think that people who are caught up in the passions of a particular incident, who've had loved ones who were affected by an incident, are pretty poorly placed to take an impartial perspective on the matter. No doubt their views and their sentiments are legitimate and warranted, and they should be part of the decision-making process, but they shouldn't be at the center of the decision-making process.
So precisely how much should we take those desires of revenge into account? Some families absolutely feel that they can only get closure if they see their daughter's killer strapped to a gurney. Political careers have been destroyed by politicians who try to pretend that this basic human impulse for revenge doesn't exist. For example, Michael Dukakis, the Democratic candidate for president in 1988, had his career and his presidential bid ruined when he gave a robotic and rational answer to an emotionally charged question about the prospect of his wife, Kitty Dukakis, being murdered.
The first question goes to Governor Dukakis. You have 2 minutes to respond. Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why...
Dukakis never really recovered from that moment, in which he was simultaneously branded as being weak on crime and detached from the normal human reaction of wanting revenge, even though what he was saying was reasonable and backed up by evidence. But still, it's absolutely understandable that some victim advocates push hard for capital punishment to be used against the worst of the worst. At the same time, though, it's important to note that there are other victims' families who feel differently, as showcased by a recent murder case in Florida.
So this is a terrible story of a murder. On a Saturday night in July 2013, a man named James Rhodes walked into a Metro PCS cell phone store in Jacksonville, Florida, and went up to the cash register. And the store manager, Shelby Farah, was standing behind the counter.
Rhodes pointed a gun at Shelby. He demanded that she open the cash register and empty it out, giving him the cash. And she did. She gave him the money. She did what he said. But it didn't make any difference.
But then Rhodes shot her in the head anyway. And she died.
Shelby was 20 years old. Rhodes, who murdered her, was only a year older.
And this was a terrible crime and involved a white victim and a black defendant.
The prosecutor opted for the death penalty. The case moved forward. But then something surprising happened.
What happened next was that Shelby Farah's mother, Darlene Farah, understandably, she was obsessed with this case, and you can totally understand that. She had lost her daughter. She was grieving. She was trying to understand what had happened. And in the course of trying to understand, she learned a lot about James Rhodes, and she found out that James Rhodes had been abused and neglected as a child, and really, as Darlene Farah came to say herself, he had been raised by the state. He'd gone into the care of the state when he was 6 years old, and he'd been abused and sexually abused while he was in state custody. And so Darlene Farrow really wrestled with these facts about James Rhodes, and she came to believe that given his own suffering at the hands of the state, it just didn't make sense to her that the state was going to kill this man. And so Darlene became really an advocate for trying to prevent the death penalty in James Rhodes' case.
And this wrinkle, well, for Darlene, it called into question whether James Rhodes was just an evil, cold-blooded killer. And her doubt about that highlights two important issues. First, there are some families of victims who would be traumatized a second time by the process of the death penalty, not only because they oppose it, but also because it creates an endless saga of appeals and courtroom appearances.
The victim families, those people who are opposed to the death penalty, have to relive this case over and over again.
But the second issue that the Rhodes case raises is how to deal with the death penalty in cases in which the perpetrator has been abused, or they have mental health issues, or they have a really low IQ, and so they're not mentally fit to stand trial.
In James Rhodes' case, he did have a low IQ score on a test, and there were questions from the beginning that his defense lawyer were raising about whether he was not eligible for the death penalty because he was intellectually disabled.
But even that issue is complicated, because some advocates for the death penalty argue that perpetrators hide behind that as a fake excuse.
So there is a lot of concern about malingering on IQ tests and also malingering as, like, you can try to pretend that you're mentally ill when you're not necessarily.
And of course, this is also a question of nature versus nurture, whether someone who commits murder and rape is a fundamentally evil person or simply a product of abuse, neglect, or violence, or poverty, or a low IQ, or mental illness. That debate isn't one that we're going to be able to resolve here. But how you feel about that question is a reasonably good predictor of whether you're going to support the death penalty or not. If you think that evil is an innate trait, that you're either born evil or you're not, then you're probably more likely to support the death penalty. And if you think that evil is learned or created by circumstance or abuse, then you're probably more likely to oppose it. So where does all of this leave us? Well, from my perspective, and this is just my perspective, I'm sure many of you will disagree with me, there's an easy out to oppose capital punishment in America, at least in its current form. You don't really have to grapple with the philosophical issues around the death penalty, because the practical issues are so problematic. Emily sums it up better than I could.
I'm a pragmatist myself, and I find those arguments compelling and in some ways easier. It's sort of like a debating position, like, well, maybe it's morally wrong, but what I can absolutely say is that it's not necessary and that the way we impose it in the United States is incredibly unjust. Like, I'm standing on a whole body of evidence when I make that claim, and so for me, that's an easier claim to make.
6 out of 10 Americans disagrees, though. Emily and I, we're in the minority. And I think the case of Russell Bucklew, a convicted murderer and rapist who is slated to die soon, illustrates the divide in a particularly harrowing way.
Tonight, new at 5, a death row inmate in Missouri claims his rare medical condition would cause him severe pain during execution. The U.S. Supreme Court has now ruled...
On Valentine's Day, 1996, Russell Bucklew got dumped. It was long overdue, too. He deserved it. He'd been abusive and violent. He started stalking his ex-girlfriend, Stephanie Ray. A few weeks later, he started making threats. He vowed to kill her, her new boyfriend, a guy named Michael Sanders, and his kids if he saw them together again. Bucklew began following them around. And in the process, he found out that Stephanie was living with her new boyfriend.
Even after 20 years as a prosecutor, Russell Bucklew is still probably one of the most evil people I've ever prosecuted.
Bucklew stole a car from his nephew and stole 2 pistols and some handcuffs from his brother. Then he drove to Sanders' trailer and broke into it. Sanders pointed a shotgun at Bucklew, but Bucklew shot Sanders first. One of the bullets went through his chest and ripped a hole in his lung. The shotgun fell to the floor and went off, blowing a hole in the wall of the trailer. Then, Bucklew shot at Sanders' 6-year-old son, but thank goodness, he missed. Bucklew's reign of terror wasn't over, though. He abducted Stephanie, his ex-girlfriend, and then he raped her. Soon, police officers located Bucklew in his car with Stephanie. A firefight between them ensued, and he was apprehended, but only after he wounded a state trooper who was trying to rescue Stephanie. Bucklew really is one of the worst of the worst. He clearly deserves to spend the rest of his life in jail. But he has challenged his upcoming execution for a unique reason. He has a rare medical condition called cavernous hemangioma. And that condition means that his body is covered with tumors that are filled with blood vessels. Because of the way the drugs used in lethal injection actually work, it is likely that those tumors would burst during the execution procedure, and that would fill his mouth with blood. He would die a slow, agonizing death. It will quite literally be torture. Bucklew challenged his execution method at the Supreme Court in April of 2019. He asked to be put to death with gas instead of lethal injection, which seems like a reasonable request. But he lost.
The US Supreme Court has ruled that a convicted murderer on death row has no right to a painless death. The ruling clears the way for the execution of Russell Bucklew, who asked for gas rather than lethal injection on the grounds of an unusual medical condition.
The Supreme Court justices, in a 5-4 decision, with the conservatives in the majority, said that he did not have the right to a, quote, pain-free death. But surely, I think we can agree that torturing him to death is barbaric, right? Just because Bucklew was a monster doesn't mean that we have to behave like one too. That being said, when you Google Bucklew's case, you can find plenty of people who have written to say that he deserves to suffer excruciating pain because of the excruciating suffering he caused. But to me, this is about what kind of society we are and what kind of values we want to represent. To me, torturing a man to death, no matter what he's done in the past, no matter how much of a monster he is, just isn't right. But if you disagree with me, which is totally fair enough, I'd ask you to at least consider the case of Nick Yaris, the troubled carjacker and drug addict who had suffered serious abuse as a child. A child who grew into a man who came within a few weeks of being executed for a crime that he didn't commit, based on a stupid lie that he told a few decades earlier. How many more Nick Yarises are out there on death row right now? How many more Nick Yarises have already been put to death? And when you ask those questions, when you really consider them, at least for me, it's hard to understand why it's possibly worth the risk that we might kill someone who's innocent, particularly in a system that is riddled with racial bias, arbitrary sentencing, and methods of execution that can, unfortunately, amount to torture. Internationally, most developed countries in the world have come to the same conclusion. In 2018, there were only 6 countries that executed more people than the US, and those 6 are not exactly a shining beacon of democracy and human rights. We're talking China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, Iraq, and Egypt. The other countries, by the way, that carried out executions last year of any number are Pakistan, Singapore, Somalia, South Sudan, Belarus, Yemen, North Korea, Afghanistan, Botswana, Sudan, and Thailand. Not exactly great company. The only other developed democracies that execute people are Taiwan and Japan. But in the United States, this debate is going to rage on, though those who oppose the death penalty are making some headway. Public support for the death penalty has declined over time. And in March 2019, California's governor commuted the sentences of everyone on death row to make them serve life in prison instead. But even on the date this episode was released, 2 prisoners were put to death in the United States. One in Alabama, and one in Florida. And it leaves us with that question. Was justice done? ¶¶ Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends about it and rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. George McDonough was the executive producer and also did the sound editing. Theme music by Scott Holmes. Audio clips at the beginning of this episode came from The Fear of 13, an excellent documentary that I suggest you go and find on Netflix. In the next episode, we look into the resource curse.
A can of tuna says this tuna came without dolphins being harmed. You'd think that we could have a bar of chocolate that said this bar of chocolate's been made without children being harmed. You'd think we could at least treat children in Africa as well as we treat the dolphins.
You've heard about blood diamonds, but what about blood chocolate? Why are some civil wars being made worse by watermelons? How are terrorists being funded by camels? Why did the steady supply of gold from the Incas help destroy the Spanish Empire? And why is it that some of the most resource-rich countries on the planet are also the same ones who struggle the most with poverty and war? Don't miss it. Goodbye for now.